Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Human industry and development change waterways and landscapes, often in challenging ways. Today, many tribes are successfully restoring wetlands, prairies, and wildlife habitat by relying on traditional wisdom about what the ecosystem is meant to do. It's a big undertaking and can take a number of years. Coming up, we'll highlight some tribal projects working to bring back resources important to Native culture. We go live right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is hearing oral arguments Thursday in a dispute between the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Indian Health Service. The tribe sued the IHS and Health and Human Services in 2016 after its hospital's emergency department went on divert status. The tribe says patients were advised at the time to seek emergency services in off-reservation towns about 50 miles away. In its suit, the tribe held the United States has a duty through the Fort Laramie Treaty to provide quality health care and an obligation through the Indian Health Care Improvement Act to raise the quality of care. Federal Judge Roberta Lange ruled the treaty does require the U.S. to provide competent physician-led health care, but said the tribe overstates the government's obligations under other federal statutes. The agencies denied having any fiduciary duty to provide health care for tribes and appealed. Three bills to address missing and murdered Indigenous people cleared another step in the Montana legislature Wednesday. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kevin Trevelin reports.
Republican Senator Jason Small of Busby said the policies build upon landmark efforts from the 2019 legislative session when lawmakers created the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force to tackle law enforcement jurisdictional issues and strengthen communication between agencies.
As the process has gone along throughout this session, we've refined a lot of what's happened and we've improved upon what we already had existing.
House Bill 98 would extend the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force until 2023 and reauthorize a grant used to maintain a missing persons database. Meanwhile, House Bill 35 would create a commission to review missing Indigenous person cold cases and analyze potential areas of law enforcement improvement. More than three quarters of Senate lawmakers gave initial approval to both proposals Wednesday, along with a third, House Bill 36, that would fund a grant program to train community-based missing person response teams. Democratic Senator Susan Weber of Browning said the teams will coordinate search efforts often conducted in collaboration with non-law enforcement personnel.
A lot of times it's the families that look for the missing person, and so they don't have any of the training.
All three bills need to pass a final Senate vote before heading to Republican Governor Greg Gianforte, who signaled support during his State of the State speech in January. Another bill extending the Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force already cleared the legislature. In an earlier interview, Senator Small said he carried the proposal in case the more expansive House Bill 98 got voted down. I'm Kevin Trevelin.
Her first day on the job Wednesday, Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland held a briefing with a group of reporters, members of the Native American Journalists Association, or NAJA. 10 journalists from both tribal and non-tribal outlets, including National Native News, joined Secretary Haaland on a video conference for a little more than 30 minutes to hear about her goals to lead the federal agency and ask questions. NAJA board member Graham Lee Brewer.
The nature of her reaching out to tribal media first and recognizing the Indigenous reporters are on the ground and know these issues better than any other journalists working in the country, I think that just kind of speaks to one of the main goals of NAJA, which is to put more Indigenous people in those newsrooms, because as Secretary Haaland proved today by giving us access before any other reporters, is that kind of diversity in your newsroom adds value to it. It gives you greater lived experiences and greater access to Indian country.
Secretary Haaland repeatedly pointed to tribal consultation as she begins work, telling reporters tribes have a seat at the table. Native journalists hope she'll continue to give access to tribal media. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme. Kawanak Broadcast Corporation is looking for an enthusiastic and creative person to manage our social media and website content, information, and application for the digital producer job at nativenews.net under employment.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
So, mother. This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homeland, Sosyawik-Dui. Tribes are building a successful track record for restoring land and waterways damaged by development and mismanagement. In Wisconsin, the United Nations successfully restored wetlands. In New York, the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe has multiple land restoration programs in and around the St. Lawrence River. And in California, the North Fork Mono Tribe and their allies restored about 6 meadows with future plans for more. These are just a few examples of how tribes are helping to heal the land with traditional ecological knowledge, science, and environmental justice work. Coming up today, we'll explore more about ecological restoration, and you're welcome to join us. Is your tribe restoring land, water, or habitat in your area? Call in, join our conversation, and tell us about it. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And today we are going to start off on the Akwesasne Nation. Joining us today on the line is Abraham Francis, and he is the Environmental Services Manager for the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne. He is Mohawk, and it is our pleasure to have him here. Abraham, welcome, and I understand you also go by Abe. So, Abe, welcome to Native America Calling.
Sago. I'm really excited to be here and share a bit of what's going on in Akwesasne.
And so, Abe, let's hear about what is going on there in terms of land restoration. What are some of the things the nation is working on?
So projects that are kind of coming up right now is we're doing a shoreline assessment in Akwesasne, and we're going to be doing a shoreline naturalization project in association with that evaluation, where we're going to really think about the ways that our traditional medicines exist along the shoreline, because we experienced a lot of environmental violence from the Seaway project that went through our territory, which widened the channel, widened and deepened the channel, which also, ended up bringing in the Moses Saunders Dam. And with that dam came industry. And so that industry ended up putting like a bunch of contaminants in the water, like mercury and PCBs. And so a lot of the work that I've been involved in since I started at Mohawk Council is in evaluating the impacts. And so it's really interesting because Akwesasne is split between the U.S. and Canada. And so we have to negotiate with the Canadian government as well as the American government in managing this and addressing the biological use impairments that are a result of that violence. And so, yeah, that's quite a bit of the work that I get to do. I also get to work on, afforestation. Right now, I've been working with some groups, and we've been doing this project to create the healing space, we call it. And it's a really great place for people to go do ceremony, but it's also built around this idea of reconciliation in Canada. And honestly, it brings together a lot of my work because for me, the restoration work isn't just about going to do projects and planting trees and putting things or sort of restoring the environment. It's all really about restoring the connection of my people to the land. And my hypothesis is that by restoring that relationship, we'll get better health outcomes for our people, but also the environment will get healthier in this reciprocal manner. So that's just a little bit on what we're doing. I mean, if you want to hear more details on the other wonderful variety of things we're working on, I'm here to answer.
I do want to hear those details. And with that, Abe, the reconnection to the land, let's talk about that, because we know that it's important in many ways. And from Akwesasne, being able to connect to the land the way we've been taught and thinking about restoration, I want to hear more. How do the two connect?
So a lot of it for me comes back to, I think about these things in a very holistic way and in the way that our culture is very interconnected. So I'm really thinking about our traditional teachings and the frameworks that we use, like the Ohanda Galiwadakwa, or what people might know as the Thanksgiving Address. and the Guyana Lhat Goa, the Great Law, and some of these foundational principles that are reflected within our landscape, as well as our cycle of ceremonies, which is that constant reminder of our roles and responsibilities to all of creation, and also that creation has a role and responsibility to us. So in restoring that relationship and that connection with the land, a lot of it for me comes back to storytelling, as well as getting people out on the land, gathering medicines, fishing and hunting and utilizing those resources, which is part of our responsibility as Unguhua people. And so what I've been kind of doing is getting all of the proposals written and negotiating the budget so we can actually really do this on the ground work. We do it somewhat passively right now, as a part of our regular operations, but I'm moving forward to make it more more engaged, more focused behind this kind of work. Because the reality is that we were dramatically impacted by residential schools, which created this.
I want to say, and you know, I got to jump in here because we got to go to break. And hearing what you're saying, for me, the word that comes to my mind is a big wedge. And lots to consider. We'll do more of that coming up after the break. But again, you can join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. When it means we are restoring our land, what does that bring to our nations? Want to hear from you? Go ahead. 1-800-996-2848 is the number to join us. Our phone lines are open.
Indigenous designers are creating a tabletop role-playing game where players navigate through an alternate future without colonization. The game hopes to gain a following among Native people and fans of other mainstream role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons. We'll discuss the role of Native RPGs on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Thanks for joining us today here on Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and it is great to be connecting with you here on these airwaves. And today we are talking about land restoration. On the line out of Aguasazni is Abe Francis. He is the Environmental Services Manager for the Mohawk Council of Aguasazni, and he is Mohawk. A pleasure to have him here. And Abe, I'm going to turn back to you. Go ahead, your thoughts.
So I guess to just finish off my thoughts from earlier is just a lot of this is about healing from that intergenerational trauma that our community has experienced. And a lot of that healing and connection comes from the land. And so by healing the land, we're healing ourselves and in that reciprocal relationship.
And so, Abe, tell me more about some of the other things that are going forward in bringing this restoration, or I guess kind of bringing this connection back to the land. Go ahead.
So a bit of this connection is just about developing like a curriculum that follows our cycles of ceremonies. We've approached the project in the past, but it's never gotten completed. And so now that's what I'm trying to do with a lot of my work. And a big part of what I'm trying to do is long-term monitoring of the ecosystem to keep an idea of how healthy it is. But all of this in like the monitoring, the engagement, the on-the-ground work is very much based on our biocultural connection and context. I think one of the most successful projects that we did with another department in our organization during COVID was we distributed raised garden beds. And within that, we based it on our sort of like the way that we would plant following the stars, but also the way like it was like corn, beans, and squash. And the reason I suggested raised garden beds is because of the contamination that we've experienced in this area. And I can't, like, I can't recommend for people to go plant in their backyards if I don't know what the sort of, if it's healthy enough for them to go plant there. So that's kind of one of the projects. I mean, you know, we're looking forward to doing stuff in our wetlands, like a wild rice restoration project, shoreline naturalization projects. And a lot of these things are continuing to grow as we move forward and as the community presents their concerns and their needs.
Well, you know, I think we have a lot to learn from the people who are working in this field. And I think just hearing your story about, you know, what this means, I also wonder what it means for the future. A lot of times some of these projects have really made an impact and have brought us back to, okay, let's go back to square one. What do we really need to be doing with the land? If this is something you can connect to as well and want to share some thoughts, go ahead and dial in now. Our phone lines are on. Our phone lines are open. Go ahead and give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Abe, for you, when you think of the work that you're doing, how does this align with what you know our ancestors hoped and promised to the land?
Well, I think everything I do, I think, in roles and responsibilities. And I think about the obligation that I have to the kinship network that I'm a part of. And so that kinship network isn't just the people. The kinship network is the trees around us, the medicines, the birds. It's all of creation. We're part of this network, and we have very specific relationships with them. The moon is our grandmother. The sun is our elder brother, you know, and our trees are our elders and mentors. And so I think about this in a lot of ways, that when I think about that relationship from a family perspective, that I'm caring for my family members. And so, and when I, if a tree is going to get removed, I'm going to think twice about it, because that's my family. That's a relationship. That's a connection right there. And when I think about that, and I think about my ancestors, I think about how they were connected to these landscapes in these very deep and meaningful ways, and that they were able to see the changes that were happening, tap into those cycles. And I feel like we kind of lost that connection. And that's where I'm in that process of trying to reclaim more of that. Because I look forward to a future where my kids are able to go and gather their medicines, like my grandmother did, that she would go and gather onanolo, which is an important medicine to us, and give me that. And I go gather onanolo, and I want my kids to be able to go gather onanolo, and their kids, and so on, that this is about this cycle and this continual process that carries on into the future. And that I'm going to be an ancestor at some point, and I want to be somebody that my that the future generations can be proud of as well. And so within that, you know, there's conversations about climate change and anticipating that and thoughts on that. But, you know, that's just a little bit of how I see our relationship as Ungwahuwe, looking into the past and thinking about the future and being careful how we walk on this land, because we're just borrowing it from future generations. And these are some of those traditional teachings that I've been gifted from my elders and clan mothers and chiefs and, you know, a variety of people.
Well, thank you for sharing them with us today here. And, you know, as we think about this and we think about what this means in terms of expressing sovereignty, too, I think that opens up a lot. If there's anything you want to share, go ahead and give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Also here, too, out of Oneida, Wisconsin, is another voice. We're going to go to the chairman of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. With us today is Chairman DeJesus Hill, and he is with us today. Chairman Hill, welcome to Native America Calling.
Greetings to everyone, and thank you for inviting me on this call today. Just in my Oneida language, and just introduce myself, DeJesus Hill, Bear Clan, and I'm Oneida. And this place where I reside is a place we call the Place of Bountiful Ducks. And so, again, thank you for the invite to participate in today's call.
And so we're curious, what is going on with the Oneida Nation when it comes to restoring ecological restoration? Tell me more.
Well, we've been doing a lot of work over the last decades as where resources become available to reacquire our reservation here. And a lot of this land was agricultural land, dairy land. So a lot of it was deforested, and the streams and creeks were altered, straightened, and that caused a lot of ecological damage that we continue to work to revive our natural environment.
And tell me about that work. What are some of the things that have been the result of that work?
Yeah, we've done quite a bit of extensive work with our wetlands on our reservation here. One of the larger projects, I guess, is the Suamico River South Branch headwaters, actually on the Oneida Reservation, and again was had its banks straightened and deepened, and the wetland area was drained and converted to cropland, and so that contributed to the degradation of the water quality and the environment for both the fish and natural wildlife in the area. And so as we acquire different properties around the reservation, and if they're deemed suitable for a restoration project, we have been relying quite heavily on the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to fund many of our restoration projects, dealing with the water being obviously next to Lake Michigan of the Great Lakes. And so being able to convert, I guess, much of this this ag land that wasn't necessarily that suitable in the first place for, you know, agriculture, row cropping and things like that, just because of the soil types and the runoff problems that happen with the streams in the watershed, and then eventually getting out to the Bay of Green Bay and causing large algae blooms and dead zone, as it's commonly referred to in the Bay of Green Bay, because of the lack of oxygen, because of the too many nutrients in our watershed. And so we've done a lot of work to restore those areas. For me, I look at it like the wetlands are like the kidneys of Mother Earth, you know, filtering that lifeblood, that water, so that it can sustain life as it moves through the ecosystem. And so any way we can to, you know, restore those watersheds, I think, goes a long way to, as was stated previously, that, you know, as we improve our environments, our health improves as well, and very much the same. We here at Oneida, we've been doing a lot of work as well to get people reintroduced to the environment and nature, and whether that's, you know, growing gardens or fishing, you know, trying to or hunting and gathering, to make sure that these things are accessible and safe. And other projects, like a lake project, was in the works for quite some time, and being able to have access to healthy fish that could be consumable, as stated, we're in very much the same boat with PCB contamination in the Fox River, which is runs kind of along our reservation, and so making the fish not edible. And so we had to figure out other ways to maintain our lifestyles and our natural diet.
And can you talk about the relationship with water? Because, you know, there are some things that people know, but when it comes to, you know, our indigenous nations, our connections to the water, why we go to the water, is beyond just putting water in our bodies. Can you explain some of that, or whatever you can publicly share? Go ahead.
Yes, definitely. You know, I was, you know, raised and had here on the Oneida Reservation, and had, you know, many elders. I like to listen more than talk, so that's one of my personal traits. But, you know, hearing stories and also the uses and the importance of water to many Native communities, as we look at it, you know, water is a medicine. And so Obviously, it sustains our lives. We can't live without water, but then also it's a cleansing as well. And so, you know, as we look to the natural environment, when it rains, we say, you know, it washes some of the tracks away, so that, you know, our path forward is more visible. And part of that too, obviously, is you know, the basic necessities of cleanliness as we're going through a pandemic, obviously. So that need for access to clean, fresh water is very important to, you know, Native communities across Indian Country. And so we really strive to make sure that, you know, we are honoring that responsibility, you know, to nature and to one another, of being able to have that philosophy of, you know, looking forward to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. You know, are we improving this place where we live, because it was in such a sad state, so that things are easier for the future generations.
Mm-hmm. And if there are things you'd like to add, go ahead and ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And when we talk about restoration of our lands, our waters, you know, what does it mean for our future generations? Just as Chairman just said, go ahead, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Chairman Hill, please describe a little bit more of just how much of the area that you're working on is. How big are the wetlands in comparison to your tribe's land base? Tell me a little bit about that, and exactly what do your wetlands look like?
Sure, definitely. The basic boundaries of our reservation is about 65,400 acres, approximately. And over the last few decades, we were able to reacquire approximately 23,000 acres of that, of our land base, back to tribal ownership. And some of the larger projects, like the South Branch Swamico River Headwaters restoration project, that was, I believe that's close to somewhere around 250, 300 acre project. And it's kind of a unique spot on our reservation, as it attracts large amounts of waterfall when they're migrating north and south with the changing of the season. And the water quality has been dramatically changed by, you know, just letting nature take its course, that we're able to, you know, find, and then also help reintroduce wild rice to that headwater as well. And so we worked with our high school students to kind of get the wild rice reintroduced into this landscape where it once was very bountiful. And so, you know, the very, very large projects like this are like an island, I guess, for wildlife, and especially migratory water birds. So we have very large flocks of, you know, Canadian geese on a regular basis, and many ducks and things like that. And sometimes you can go out there in the spring and fall when their migration is the heaviest, and you could barely see the water. It's covered with waterfall.
And, you know, just hearing about your nation as well as the Mohawk Nation and some of the work that they're doing, how does that compare to what is actually going on in your own tribal community? And so when we say land restoration, we are talking about bringing, you know, of course, what you see on the ground, as well as our waterways. And when we do take the efforts, you know, what changes, and especially people who, you know, understand our connection to the land and how vital it is to understanding who we are as Native people. And want to hear your thoughts on that too. And then specifically about the work when it comes to wanting to do things like this, what kind of regulations are in place? What kind of hurdles are you running into doing this kind of work in your own tribal community? And what drove you to this type of work? Is it something that you were raised with, teachings your elders brought to you? Maybe you even see the science side of things, of when we do bring balance, you know, what happens to our ecosystem? And what about doing some of this to make sure that the animals and the water beings both have a safe environment to be in. We know we care about them. We know we're so they're woven into our culture. What about the benefits to them as well when we do some of these restoration projects? Love to hear from you. Go ahead, dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And if you have any questions for the folks that we have on the phone, go ahead, dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We definitely look forward to hearing from you today. We'll keep the phone lines open. We're going to pause for a moment. But again, we're ready for your calls. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Go ahead and join us. And if you are finding us in a podcast, leave your comments directly on our website, nativeamericacalling.com.
Did you know COVID financial relief in the form of forgivable PPP loans is available to small business owners and independent contractors, including artists? DreamSpring has worked with New Mexicans looking to open or expand their business for over 25 years, and now they're helping provide PPP loans. Information, including how to qualify, at dreamspring.org. That's dreamspring.org. DreamSpring supports this program.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we are focusing on tribal ecological restoration today, and there is still time to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today on the line out of Oneida, Wisconsin, is Chairman DeHasi Hill. And also here, too, is Abe Francis on the line out of Aguasazni, and he is the Environmental Services Manager for the Mohawk Council of Aguasazni. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here with us, and I got a caller on the line. Let's go ahead and say hi to Hank, who joins us today out of Taos, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Thanks for giving us a ring, Hank. You're on air.
Hey, thank you. I just want to say some of these projects sound amazing to reclaim Mother Earth and clean our watersheds and our waterways. And I know it seems a little bit overwhelming for like most people out here in the world, but we can all just do a tiny piece by just grabbing one grocery bag or one trash bag and just go picking up trash for 10 minutes. And all that those little pieces contribute to that bigger piece. And because some of those projects, I think for me, could seem overwhelming. So I just wanted to say that that's what I do, and picking up trash is a great way to pray. That's all I wanted to say. I thank you guys for what you do. I learned so much from this program.
We appreciate you tuning in, Hank. Wish you the best. And again, join us. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're going to say hi now to another caller. Bruce is joining us today out of Yakima, Washington, tuned in on KYNR. Bruce, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Thank you for this moment. I have two questions. One is regarding the legal process where a property outside of an existing reservation boundary can be brought into tribal trust. And I'll give an example. The Yakima Nation originally was much larger area of central Washington and south central Washington. So let's just take an example. Maybe some property up in the Natchez watershed, maybe 1,000 acres or something, you know, which was very nation original. Can that property be brought back into tribal trust? You know, I don't know how that works.
Okay. I'm going to toss that to our guest, Chairman Hill. Any thoughts for our caller, Bruce?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I guess, federal regulations in place as it relates to taking land into trust and the purpose for that, taking that land into trust. And I know there's, I think, a couple different processes that are followed. And I can't remember the particulars about the definitions of near reservation acquisition of trust land, what that distance might be. So I can't answer very specifically, but I think another way that I think we here at Oneida continue to work with our larger community partners, other municipalities in the area and, you know, on and off the reservation, is creating those stronger relationships so that we can work together hopefully in the future on these larger projects, you know, off the reservation, because the major waterway that comes through our reservation is Duck Creek, and those headwaters are probably 10 to 15 miles away from us, and we don't have, I guess, per se, the jurisdiction of putting our best management practices on those headwaters, but, you know, creating those relationships in those communities and being able to demonstrate best management practices and things like that to influence, you know, other areas to adopt those to make sure that the water waterways are being taken care of and that we're continuing to fulfill our responsibilities to that water as it continues to fulfill those responsibilities to us.
Thank you for that, Chairman. And thank you for your call as well, Bruce. Again, phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Also here with us today from Clovis, California, is Ron Good. He is the tribal chairman for the North Fork Mono Tribe. Our pleasure to have him here. Chairman Good, thank you for joining us.
Manahu. How is everybody doing today?
Well, I hope they're doing good.
Thank you for allowing me to come on. Quite an honor to listen to, you know, the Oneida folks and the Mohawk. I'm connected worldwide, and I try to work with Indigenous people all over. We work a lot with the Mardu of Western Australia and the Maori of New Zealand, and I've been online with First Nation up in Canada and the Hawaiian folks. And as soon as I'm off of this call, I'm going out to on Zoom with Seminoles. And, you know, part of what my interest is to hear what, you know, our Indigenous people are doing worldwide. And like it was said earlier on one of the calls, that one of the call-ins, you know, that we got to all work in our backyards. It's basically all that we have jurisdiction over anymore. And that's kind of what, you know, we spoke about when I was with the Aborigine folks who had a very similar situation as us, picked off the land for a while. And, you know, then fire came and destroyed everything. So with that said, then, you know, this is our opportunity. As a tribe, I work with all my neighboring tribes, the Miwok and our Donalat Mono people and our Big Sandy people and some of the Yokich tribes down in the valley. We put a lot of fire on the land. Most of us are doing a lot of cultural burning and burning on our private lands, our reservation rancheria lands, and on county, state, federal lands as well. One of the key things that, as you mentioned earlier, that we do meadow restoration, and one of the things that we did was we restored six meadows during the drought, and we got nine more that's on our platter right now. But back in 2018, we signed an agreement with the Sierra National Forest, the master agreement, one of the only kind right now, to give us full authority to do cultural burning on the forest that will be conducting it. And we'll also be doing our own training, and we'll also be doing our own certification. Part of that is we've been working with the forest for many years, and when they train their people, you know, certify them, and then they send them out to us to work. And then we have to retrain them, you know, and teach them a little bit about, you know, what we're doing. Not only that, sometimes how to use the tools properly. Agencies have a whole different concept of what they're doing when they're out there. Our cultural burning that we're doing, we burn in four different counties, but we just held our biggest one in February in Mariposa and had over 55 people come to volunteer. We used about a dozen different tribes, pretty close to a dozen different agencies, from, you know, CAL FIRE to U.S. Forest Service and Governor's Office and a number of other conservation groups that come out, as well as community people and colleges. We use a lot of college work, and colleges help to fund our projects. So a weekend of cultural burning runs about $8,000 to $10,000. And so, you know, we have to have this extra funding. Funding is pretty hard for us to find. We apply for grants, and occasionally we get some small ones. We're working on the larger money through the state right now, and CAL FIRE is working with the governor to try to bring about $10 million into tribes throughout California. We hope to get that accomplished this coming year. There already is going to be some money, about $1 million, that's going to be available via CAL FIRE coming up this early summer. So that's going to be a good thing for all of us. And there are quite a few tribes in California that are doing burning and restoration work. And as, you know, the other two wonderful folks have just pointed out about, you know, the restoration they're doing in around Great Lakes and, you know, and on your rivers and watersheds. I think if you understand, you know, where the native people lived, then you'll know that they were connected to water. They needed to be nearby water, whether it be springs or creeks or rivers or lakes or ponds, all these different aspects to be able to thrive out there on the land. And so in California, you know, this year we had probably the most devastating fires. 4% of California burned, but pre-1850, you know, 2% of California was always on fire, and the Indians had a big part of that, and we constantly burned, and we've been here for thousands of years, and so, you know, the footprint that we've left is, you know, sometimes not even seeable, because we had the land open and we were able to burn without scarring and without damage to our resources. And even our cultural burning right now, the whole aspect of the difference between cultural burning and prescribed fire is we want to rejuvenate our land. We want to bring our resources back. We're taking care of the dead and dying resources and restoring them to life, and when they come back to life, they're able to hold water, they're able to retain water through their root system, and once you've burned, you've opened the land, and that will stay open for, you know, 6 to 8 years before you even begin to get sickness back, and 15 years before, you know, you better put more fire on the ground. Typically, when we were allowed to burn back in the 1800s, we put as much as 3 fires into an area in every 10 years. And you didn't have to burn again, but maybe once in the next 20 years. Unfortunately, today we are not able to, you know, get that practice like we would like to be able to do. But just the fact that we're able to put fire back on the land and bring the water back, raise the water table back up, which in turn allows all of our resources and species to come back. So, you know, I use this, you know, crazy cliche that says, if you build it, they'll come. And if you restore a meadow and you open that meadow up and the water comes back, your flowers, your plants, your cultural resources, the animals, they all start coming back, and pretty soon, you know, your meadow is a completely functional functional, not just because it has water and because it's operating the way it's supposed to, but because we have everybody back living there. And so we monitor our species from plants and insects and animals and everybody that's out there to where we go from. So probably when we're first there on the land, it's like 20 species that we might count. But when we're done after 3 or 4 years, then we're looking at 150, 160 different species, you know. That might include the ladybugs that are there, like, you know, 100,000 of them. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that is important when you're restoring, you know, and rejuvenating the land. As a tribe, we are an Aboriginal tribe. We're not federally recognized, but we have a rancheria that is federally recognized. They belong to us. We don't belong to them because we run, our homeland is about 1.4 million acres. And so we work with several federal agencies, state agencies, counties, and ensuring that, you know, whatever practices they're doing and whatever practices we're doing are able to be done adequately.
And when things start to return, I know that's a big thing. And Chairman, I know you got to get going here. Is there anything else or do you need to go?
I don't know. I'm not looking at the time. I'm just talking. I don't know. I'm excited to listen to the other folks talk, and it just means a lot to me when I hear, you know, what other people are doing. And, you know, we still have a long ways to go in terms of colonial policies that we fight with, especially here in California. You know, technically, as a burn boss or as a tribe, you know, I carry a $2 million liability. If I don't, then I'm the one that's going to be held liable if a fire gets away from us. California has established some earlier laws that says if we want Cal Fire to come in and burn for us, and then, you know, for us, it's like, no, I'm trying to train Cal Fire. And, you know, then they got a new rule in AB 332, talking about how they're going to get liability for burn bosses, you know, so that they are covered, because the governor wants ranchers and tribes and counties to all start doing more burning. And so that's a good thing. But there again, what I'm saying to you is that, you know, as a tribe, if we want to burn, we're in a sense burning illegally, unless we are fully covered, and which we do, but it's also your technique.
Sure. And, you know, tribes, the knowledge that they bring to this, and we've done some coverage on this, but I always continue to learn about when these practices are put back in place, what it brings. Lots to consider. We got to wrap things up. Thanks to everybody we heard from in the hour. Join us again tomorrow for Role Playing Games. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
How me takuya piki? We chose on uapi tokaya ikigina kapo. Wana March 15, 2021. Waheha luhapicha uch iguapo. La kozania oti iliapo isamasola chihantas. Nish lil yayo, healthcare.gov, nish lil mas apkayo. 1-800-318-2596. Le wot khaniki, Medicare na Medicaid oti atahi apelo. Ho, hechetuelo.
Thank you.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.